Now, tomorrow night, the satirical newspaper and website The Onion arrives in cable TV sports news. The Onion has turned its already popular online sports site into a half-hour show on Comedy Central, which spoofs the kind of coverage seen on ESPN. Here's NPR's Mike Pesca.
Good times are the enemy of good satire. Some despair over high unemployment, political vitriol, an entertainment culture that rewards louts and loons and birds falling from the sky. The Onion takes it as something of an apocalyptic opportunity.
Patriots head coach Bill Belichick has thrown acid in the face of his star quarterback, Tom Brady. Apparently, out of jealousy that Brady was handsome and loved, while he himself was a hideous monster.
This is The Onion Sports Dome, an offshoot of the satirical newspaper The Onion. The DNA of ESPN's Sports Center is so infused in the visual grammar of the Sports Dome that you could picture disoriented ESPN anchor John Buchagross wandering onto the wrong set one day and hosting the fake broadcast by mistake. The Sports Dome takes down not only the ridiculous excesses of the sports world, but the specific high-energy, high-fiving, high-decibel techno beat underscoring highlight packages that ESPN traffics in. Now, the Sports Dome's take is not for the easily offended, or even the moderately offended. Look, you're going to be offended. For instance, the premiere episode is scheduled to have a segment that's in terrible taste given recent events.
Let's go to the kill down. Major League Baseball, still a ton of productive players who can't find jobs, and we're hearing cries of collusion. Doc, who do you kill?
I kill Bud Seeley. Ex-owner loves to watch the players get screwed high and low.
But the joke isn't, wouldn't it be funny to kill Bud Selig or the entire offensive line of the Oakland Raiders, which is also proposed. It's the hyperbolic lack of perspective that characterizes the sports media. The sports talk radio show I listen to, for instance, poses hypotheticals this way. Gun to your head, who do you want as quarterback, Hasselbeck or Whitehurst? As if it would be impossible to consider the Seahawks' depth chart without an invitation to bodily harm. A lot of the Sports Dome's jokes go immediately to the very dark. And coupled with the energy of the production, I wonder if they'll be able to carve out the right space for a version of those great slice-of-life Onion stories, like Area Man constantly mentioning he doesn't own a television. But the show excels in nailing the details. Take this clip where St. Louis Cardinals slugger Albert Pujols is offered a key to the city, a literal key, which would unlock the doors to every residence and business.
Full unlimited access to St. Louis. No questions asked.
Our homes, our cars, our internet access, our showers, and whatever's in our fridge. All of it is yours, Albert. The buffet is open.
The clip was supposedly taken from an outdoor press conference. Did you notice how the mic sounded different from the studio anchor who introduced the clip and how the public official's mic picked up the sound of traffic? I don't know if the Onion Sports Dome will find an audience which rests in the shared area of the Venn diagram containing sports and black comedy. But I predict that the day after the Sports Dome airs, it will be the talk of ESPN, with the consensus opinion being they've got us down pretty good, followed by, and has anyone seen John Buchagross? Mike Pesca, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
Tonight, the FX network presents a new drama series called Lights Out, about a retired heavyweight boxer contemplating a comeback. Our TV critic David Bianculli says it's a very good show, and so far, a very good year for television.
I'm not sure what's going on here, but I definitely approve. In the first week of 2011, the Showtime cable network gave us the premiere of Episodes, the Matt LeBlanc comedy that may end up as the best new comedy series of the year. And now, in the second week of 2011, the FX network gives us Lights Out, which may well end up 50 weeks from now as the best new drama series of the year. This much fresh quality television so early in the year, I've never seen anything like it. But I love what I'm seeing. Lights Out, on the surface, has the same basic template as The Fighter, the new movie starring Mark Wahlberg. That film is about a boxer, his chance at a title shot, and the tough-as-nails, hot-tempered, loose-cannon family that's in his corner, for good and for bad. Same premise in Lights Out, except this time there are other issues involved, like money and mobsters. Lights Out is created by Warren Light, who ran season 2 of In Treatment for HBO. His more significant credit, though, and one that applies more directly, is that he wrote the fabulous Tony Award-winning Broadway play Sideman, about a jazz musician and his son. That play really dove into family dynamics in a big way, while also exploring and explaining an intense type of artistic dedication. What Sideman did with jazz, Lights Out does with boxing. The star of the TV series is Holt McElhaney, playing Patrick Leary, a heavyweight champ. In the opening scene, his wife Teresa, played by Catherine McCormick, begs him to retire after a brutal loss in the ring. He does, and the series cuts to 5 years later. Patrick's ex-boxer brother, played by Pablo Schreiber, is now his business manager. And their father runs a local boxing gym that Patrick bought with his prize money. But that money has all dried up, as Patrick admits while driving home his dad, played by a perfectly crusty Stacy Keach.
See my kid in the ring? I'm telling you, with a little time, Omar could go all the way.
I need to talk to you.
I mean, he reminds me of your brother coming up. Doesn't have the reach.
Did you know that was the IRS in today?
Well, I'll tell you what I told your brother. I've seen the IRS come after fighters all my life. You don't play cute with them. Whatever they say you owe, you just pay. You listen to me?
I'm broke, Dad.
What?
I got nothing to pay him with. It's all gone.
How?
I don't really know.
Does Teresa know?
No. And she's not gonna.
And it's her fault in the first place. I mean, I love her, but there was big money on the table, and she took you out of the game.
McElhaney is totally believable as the former heavyweight. The actor has real experience as a boxer, which is obvious, but he's also got the weary credibility of someone who's been through a lot. For the same reason, I love that Keach was cast as the father. He played a washed-up boxer in Fat City, a movie made way back in 1972, and every line in his face seems to be acting the part. The rest of the supporting cast, the unsavory characters who help, hurt, or tempt lights along the way, is just as good. Some are from The Wire or Oz. Others, like Bill Irwin, who's usually clowning around but plays it menacingly straight here as a white-collar mobster, are impeccably, inventively cast. FX sent out all 13 episodes of this first season for review, and it's obvious why. They keep getting better and better, and the path to the hoped-for comeback bout is anything but straightforward. Each episode ends, at the closing credits, with a boxing ring bell going off, like it's signaling the end of another round. And often, based on what you've just watched, it feels that way. You'll want to head back to your neutral corner and take a rest. Not only after the scenes that take place inside the ropes, but all of them. Lights Out is that intense and that good.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of TVWorthWatching.com and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews Amy Chua's controversial new memoir about her approach to parenting. This is Fresh Air.
Okay, you could call this clever advertising, or you could call it a lack of boundaries. Maybe you've noticed TV commercials are now aping the look and style of whatever show happens to be playing. They're called podbusters, and they're designed to stop people on their digital video recorders from fast-forwarding through the commercials. NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Dan Portnoy is not a big TV watcher. He follows very few shows, but he likes his favorites a lot.
I'm a big fan of Mad Men, and so I watch it religiously.
One evening, Portnoy was speeding through the commercials as usual. He saw the program had started again, so he stopped fast-forwarding to watch the ad execs at Sterling Cooper banter.
Notice anything different about me?
You're gaining weight.
No.
You're getting shorter. You've lost a tooth. You're drunk. You're sober. A little bit of both.
Now, it looked like Mad Men. It sounded like Mad Men. But it was an ad for shampoo.
I felt snookered.
Still, Portnoy had to admit the ad was diabolically effective.
By the time you realize that it's an advertisement, you're pretty much all the way through the commercial.
Podbusters, DVR busters, interstitial ads. Whatever you want to call them, they've been a valuable weapon in the war to deliver eyeballs to advertisers. About 40% of U.S. households have digital video recorders. That means 40% of households can easily speed over commercials. So it helps a show like Top Chef get advertisers if it sprinkles attention-grabbing bits of content inside advertising blocks, or as they're called in the industry, pods. So it's near the end of Top Chef. You want to see who's won. You're fast-forwarding through commercials. You see the chef testants in the stew room, and you hit play to see the judge's decision. But instead, you get a minute of their behind-the-scenes dance-off.
You were doing later, though, weren't you?
And some backstage chatter.
Isabella, man. Isabella is, like, the biggest kid out of all of us.
Take what your mama gave you!
Then there are more commercials. It's a trick to put Podbusters towards the ends of shows during maximum fan engagement. There's other kinds of Podbusters, too, like the ones featuring actors from whatever show you're watching. You've seen that if you follow Glee or 30 Rock.
That was a real good hugger.
For exclusive 30 Rock Holiday Fun Times, card members go to nbc.com/American Express.
One ad executive told me the most effective Podbusters drive viewers online, where they'll use social media to interact with their programs and the products that sponsor them.
We have data that will show second by second what viewers are doing during these commercial breaks, what kind of behaviors are going on. So we've gotten a much better sense of what works and what doesn't work.
That's Mike Rosen, a president with the media agency Starcom USA. I asked him if a recent 10% jump in TV ad spending had anything to do with Podbusters. He said indirectly. Seeing ads that reflect the shows you like, he said, makes you transfer your good feelings about the show to the products advertised on them. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
By the way, we've gathered a few of these Podbuster ads at our website. If you're curious, you can go to npr.org. But if you don't have time to do that, don't worry. The ads will sneak up on you anyway.
Cowboys are back. Movie fans have ponied up over $100 million so far to see the Coen brothers' True Grit. Earlier this week, a member of the All Things Considered staff made this embarrassed confession during our morning editorial meeting. He said he had seen True Grit and was surprised to find that he liked it. Surprised because, as he admitted, he didn't think he liked Westerns. Needless to say, he grew up in a post-Gunsmoke, post-Rawhide, and post-Bonanza decade, and we reckoned that he wasn't alone. So, for those of you who roll your eyes at the thought of a drunken saloon brawl or a ride into the sunset, we have invited Bob Mondello, our movie critic, to give us a little starter kit for the multiplex tenderfoot. Howdy, Bob.
Howdy.
Let's start with some basics. What makes a Western a Western?
Well, white hats, black hats, guns, frontier codes of honor, big sky country, I guess.
There are a lot of Westerns that have been made, and we asked you to pick a few. Let's start with the earliest pick on your list. It's from 1953, Shane.
I've heard about you. What have you heard, Shane?
I've heard that you're a low-down Yankee liar.
Now, this is a classic Western. You've got a good guy, Alan Ladd, and the bad guy there was Jack Palance. And it's about being pure in the way that America was pure. It's about the going out there, and it's the frontier, and you're going to make everything right somehow.
Now, a starter kit wouldn't be complete without at least one movie from the director who single-handedly built the Western from the ground up, John Ford, and his favorite star, John Wayne. But the film that you've picked, which was released just 3 years after Shane, is not typical of Ford, Wayne, or the genre. Tell us about the movie The Searchers.
Right. The Searchers is complicated. It's about something more than just good and bad. The good guy, John Wayne, is an unrepentant racist in this. He hates the Comanches. And it's very much about how the settlers treated the Native Americans in that period. It's a very complicated, gorgeous, epic Western.
It's about gray hats.
That's exactly right.
For the next pick, Bob, one which rewrote the rules of the Western a bit, and which can be summed up in one quick line.
If they move, kill them.
It's actor William Holden, the ringleader of The Wild Bunch by director Sam Peckinpah. Why The Wild Bunch?
Well, if the Western can be about something in the Wild West, it can be about other things too. And Peckinpah decided to make this picture about violence. It is much more violent than the previous pictures. A lot of blood on screen, a lot of slow motion violence. And he intended that as a comment on Vietnam. This came out in 1969, and so he meant this to be about other social issues, not just the ones from the Wild West.
And it was that vivid violence that turned off a lot of people, but that changed the rules of making a Western.
Absolutely.
On your list, proving that you're not too predictable, you've added a comedy, one of my favorites, Mel Brooks's Blazing Saddles. And this is not John Ford's Western.
Dang.
sheep.
How about some more beans, Mr. Taggart?
I'd say you've had enough.
I'd say he'd had enough, too. They'd all had enough. That's the campfire scene from Blazing Saddles. I should warn people that this is definitely rated R. The subject matter and the language tend to be pretty adventuresome for the age, but it was a very, very funny picture.
And finally, no list would be complete without at least one film from Clint Eastwood. Which one did you pick?
Oh, no, this was hard because you want to pick one of the spaghetti westerns, but I finally decided that I had to pick something from a little later. It's as if the Western stopped coming out in 1970, so I picked Unforgiven.
I thought they was gonna get us. I was even scared a little, just for a minute. Was you ever scared in them days?
I can't remember. I was drunk most of the time.
It is a magnificent Western from 1992, really epic. It's about the old outlaws. This is the end of the era. A lot of people thought, actually, that it was a sort of a eulogy for the form. It ended up not being a eulogy for the form because they made a whole lot of other pictures after it. It sort of inspired a Western revival.
That's a very interesting list you've compiled.
And it's by no means complete, and I know that. I mean, this is five pictures. I've got about 20 on our website, npr.org. If you go there, you can maybe somebody could give us their own starter kit for people who don't like Westerns. I think if you look at these five pictures, though, and you still don't see anything you like, you really don't like Westerns.
Okay. Bob Mondello, thanks for providing us with a starter kit for liking Westerns.
Always a pleasure.
He rode a blazing saddle. He wore a shining star. His job to offer battle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.